call the Duval delegation meeting to order. And Paula, if you will call the roll, and then we'll go ahead and get started.
Okay. Representative Atkins?
Here.
Representative Fant? Excuse. Representative Fullwood? Representative Jones?
Here.
Representative McBurney? Representative Ray?
Here.
Senator Bean?
Here.
Senator Gibson? Excused.
Very good. And I want to thank the members that are here tonight to attend this meeting. And I want to thank everybody else who made the trip here to Tallahassee to attend. This is an important issue that is in search of solutions. The purpose of today's meeting is to allow members an opportunity to gain a deeper understanding of how the low-income pool is used by our hospitals in Jacksonville. So there's a $2.17 billion gap in the LIP funds. But those LIP dollars are used for a variety of purposes, such as raising the Medicaid payment rates to Medicare levels, enhancing hospital payment rates, and funds to support our special purpose hospitals like trauma centers and safety net hospitals and children's hospitals. So I believe it'll be helpful for members tonight to gain an understanding of how our local hospitals pull down those LIP dollars in each of these categories. I believe a better understanding of how the LIP funds are used will improve our ability to craft a solution as we move forward. So if we could begin by having everybody in the audience, if you'll just take a moment to introduce yourself, and especially if you're someone who's representing a hospital, I'm going to ask you to come to this table over here so we can have a better back and forth. Because, again, the idea is to try to get a better understanding. We're going to get in the weeds to get a better understanding of how that $2.17 billion, how that personally impacts not just the $97 million that is the gap for a particular hospital, but how we are drawing down that $97 million. So let's begin. Marty, I'll start with you to begin the introductions, and then we'll go around.
Paul Martin, I represent UF Health Jacksonville.
Mario Rubio, City of Jacksonville.
Russ Armistead, the CEO of UF Health Jacksonville.
Erica Howell with the Law Firm of Foley Rogers.
Joe Alvano,
Senator Aaron
Dean. Joe Untop, Senator Aaron Dean.
Paul Blanton, Flagler Hospital.
Richard Perrault with Representative Bernie.
Brian Jogers, Baptist Hospital. I also represent Brooklyn Rehabilitation Hospital.
Philip Boyce, I'm Senior Vice President at Baptist Health.
Lane Smith, Mayo Clinic.
Elon Thompson, representing the Jones Office.
Okay, very good. So I'm going to ask the representatives from, and let's go over here in the back. I'm sorry.
Mark Pinto, representing UF Health Jacksonville.
Canada with UNF.
Joe Mobley, represent UNF. I'm sorry.
Well, we do that too. UF Health Jacksonville.
Okay, very good.
Mark Lloyd, Representative Ray's office.
Okay, very good. Okay, so if I can ask the reps from UF Health, Baptist, and Mayo to come to the table here so that we can have a dialogue. And I'm hopeful that, and I've got a series of questions. Okay, so, and if we don't have the answers today, then that's fine, but I'd like to try to get these answers as we move forward. Because let's pretend that as we move forward that, and I think the number is 97 million, is that correct? 95 million. Okay, so it's a 95 million, that's kind of the umbrella. But help me understand what the details of that 95 million look like. So you're covering uninsured, you're raising some rates to the Medicare levels. Can you tell us how those dollars, how these $95 million breaks down?
No. It's a complicated formula. I can get you the details. If I remember, there's seven different programs under what's generically called LIP. I can tell you one of them is called Special LIP, and we get $31 million out of that bucket of the LIP program, and I think that particular bucket is about $90 million. We get 31 of it, and it's the special Senator Jim King money that was put in. It's an earmark directly for Shands Jacks, UF Health Jacksonville. So that 31 is specifically in that program earmarked for us, and we get
a third
of the amount for all the hospitals. There are other programs that I can't tell you, because some are used to buy rate down, and some are used to essentially get us funds. And in our budget, it's $95 million in total to the hospital. In addition, there's another $25 million that's in the physician component of LIP that goes to the UF doctors for the care, the Medicaid or Intergent care that they provide, that they need that money as well. That's a separate program from the hospital LIP program. And those other categories, I have a schedule, but I'd have to go back and tell you exactly which particular tranche that runs through that we get revenue. But it's $95 million out of my $550 million budget. So it's a huge number.
So it's just shy of 20%.
Just, yeah.
Give or take.
Yep.
Okay, so the problem at UF Health is the $95 million plus the $25 million for the physician payments. What's the problem? How big is the problem at Baptist?
Well, we have Children's Hospital, and then we have a hospital up in Nassau County, which is the only hospital in that county with a rural hospital designation.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe there's a bucket regarding rural hospitals.
Right.
So that's different than with the Children's Hospital. About almost 60% of the patients at the Children's Hospital are Medicaid. Medicaid covers about 55% of our costs. So I believe we're just under $14 million in terms of LIP funding for both the Children's Hospital and Nassau, with the majority of that being for the Children's Hospital.
So $14 million kind of total, roughly.
Correct. And I don't know the breakdown between the two, other than the majority is for pediatric health care.
Okay.
You said that's what percentage for the pediatric?
I'm not sure of the percentage, but the majority is, you know, the majority of our Medicaid is in the, with the pediatric health care with the Wolf
Children's
Hospital.
But in terms of the Children's Hospital, about how much of that care is under Medicaid?
Almost 60%.
60%,
yeah.
That's what I thought. Okay.
And then I heard you say that roughly 60% of your patients are Medicaid, and that Medicaid covers roughly 55% of the cost.
Right, and that's pediatric.
For pediatrics.
Right, which might have a little bit different cost structure than adult.
Okay. So if we define the size of the problem at Baptist, we would define that as roughly $14 million.
Correct.
Okay. And what about at Mayo?
It's not a significant problem for us.
Okay, so we're good.
Do you lose anything?
Indirectly. We get just a token amount for some quality adjustments, but it's not significant.
$1 million, $2 million.
$6,000.
$6,000?
$6,000, $550.
Okay, so it's a blip. Okay. All right. Walk me through, and from what I've heard and read in the media, it's UF Health that's really the one that's suffering the most in the Jacksonville area. Would everybody sort of agree with that?
I would,
yes. Let me just state that we found out about the meeting this morning. Hugh Green wanted me to express, you know, regrets for not being able to attend. He had a board commitment, but that, you know, definitely we're here to support UF. I mean, it's safety in that hospital, our community. And while it impacts us, it really impacts UF. So I totally agree with that statement.
Very good.
That's why we're here, too.
Very good.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
So help me understand, do we know of the $95 million, how much of that is because we're providing care to the uninsured?
It's actually My sense is this was a source of funding that was set up in 2006 as a way, and the, for example, the $31 million for us was a way to plug the hole in financing for Shands or UofL Jacksonville. We didn't have enough revenue to support what we were doing. And so the funds are really designed not just for Medicaid, but to cover high expense areas like neonatal unit, trauma, and indigents who we don't have other funding for. So, and the reason we're the poster child, I believe, is that we don't have any reserves. What I've got is 50 to 60 days of cash, and I have the lowest Moody's investment grade rating, meaning that if I get downgraded again, then the investment quality is considered junk. And so the interest rate on the existing debt I have would go up because, again, just not meeting financing requirement. So when you're in the last year, we made $2.5 million. That was the best year we've had in the three I've been there. We lost $5 million the year before. We lost $23 the year before that. And actually, the year before that, I think we made $15 million. What happened was in 08, when the state, when the economy went in the tank, the state didn't have the money to pay the Medicaid rates. And so we lost $25 million a year for 3 years in a row in Medicaid rates. And that's what triggered our loss. And we blew the balance sheet. Because when you lose money like that, the investors pay attention. So we're basically operating close to break even. This year I'm actually, I think I'm close to $5 million ahead through March. But on a $500 million budget, that's fairly narrow. So you don't have to be real smart to figure out if you take $95 million out, you can't make it. Even if you take $50 million out, I can't. I mean, the creditors understand where we are. I'm not having problems with creditors, but if I lose $20 or $25 million, I'm going to have people looking at us saying, are we viable?
And I'm going to invite the other members. If you have a question, just jump in at any time. What I'm trying to get to, though, is of the $95 million that you're short through the LIP, is the majority of that because of care to uninsured that you're providing and drawing down from LIP, or is the majority of it because you've got some high-cost, like neonatal and trauma and such? Where's the breakdown for UF?
It's a combination, but it's mostly indigent care.
How much? Give me a number. I need numbers because at the end of the day, every hospital has a different case mix. And I need to know, and these members need to know, what your case mix is, because as complicated as the formula is, as we look to craft a solution, understanding which elements of that formula are most important to you, I think will help all of these members as we try to craft that solution.
Sure.
Does that make sense? Is what I'm... What I'm asking?
Yes, but the $95 million is not paid to us now based on our case mix volume.
So how do you draw it down?
There's a formula that, based on, and I'd have to get you the criteria, it determines how much money we're going to get for this coming year. I can tell you my case mix is I'm 15% uninsured.
Okay.
Typical hospital is probably 2 to 8. I'm 15. What kills me is I'm 10% commercial. Most hospitals are 25 to 30. Commercial is hospital industry is pretty simple. There's two payers. It's commercial insurance and the government. Mm-hmm. The government pays Medicare and Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
And hospitals make money on commercial. Sorry, we overcharge. And with those profits, we use it to cover the Medicaid and the uninsured. The problem I have is We have a low commercial insurance business. It's just historic. And we have a high Intigent, and we have a high Medicaid, of about 40% Medicaid. So 40% Medicaid, a typical hospital probably has 18 to 25% Medicaid. So I have twice as much Medicaid and half as much commercial. So that's why it's difficult for us to make enough money, because each hospital is really responsible for the Intigent care that they provide. Any of these patients without resources can walk into any of the, I mean, they can go to Baptist or Mayo, they can go anywhere they want. It's just that historically, we have been the place that provides most of that care. We're perfectly comfortable with that role, but we don't get enough, frankly, we don't get enough city support to cover the Intigent. There are 140,000 uninsured in Jacksonville. The $26 million we get from the city is for a group of patients who can prove they live in Duval County and who make less than the federal poverty level. That tends to be 10 to 12,000 people. But I can assure you all 140,000, when they need health care, believe that because the city gives us $26 million, we're their place. So we take care of anybody who walks in, just as these hospitals would. It's just they tend to walk in more to our place.
So let's talk about when somebody comes into your hospital and they're not insured. What mechanisms, what protocol is followed to identify whether or not they're eligible for like a medically needy program or Medicaid or KidCare or one or the other? Is there a protocol in place when somebody comes in and they say, I need care, but I don't have insurance?
Sure. And just as each of these hospitals. First of all, federal law, we're required to not ask you whether you have anything. We triage you and determine what level of care you need. Once that's been done, we then ask if you have insurance, if you have cash, how are you going to pay. And we have a whole group of people, group as in 14, in a department that does nothing but deal with individuals to help them if there is a program that they can qualify for to get them in that program. So we have people that do that all the time. And we're in the city, we're very careful to make sure that only people that qualify are included in the city contract. And what the city contract means is we then take that individual and say, we have a primary care practice, we have physicians, we have five clinics that we will see you. Okay, you're a city contract patient, and it's primary care. We want to keep them out of the emergency room. But the people who don't have insurance, we don't do that because I can't afford it. I mean, we see 90,000 ED visits a year. We admit about 35,000 patients to the hospital. So 15% of that, give you an idea of the number of people. And if they don't have any resources, then we deal with them just as any hospital would. We treat the acute injury. But if they have a chronic issue that's not presenting, we don't treat because we can't afford it. I mean,
So the people who come to your emergency room, there's 90,000 emergency room visits. Mm-hmm. Do you have any numbers on how many of those people are coming for primary care? Or maybe they fall within the category, but they're coming for primary care, they're coming to get a prescription written because they've got no other place to go.
The difference, we get about 75% of our admissions from the emergency room.
Okay.
So 75% of 35,000 or 33, so that's maybe 25. So it's probably 10, 12,000 people. No,
it'd be more than that. It'd be more like...
But if we get 75% of our admissions from the
20,000.
Emergency room, and our admissions are 35,000, then the difference between that and 90,000 we see are not admitted they have some less acute issue. And I don't want to hesitate to guess, but as I talk to our physicians, there's a relatively small segment that are in there for what I call refills or sort of lumps and bumps. Most people have some issue, and remember, some of these folks, their home situation is not good, so we may have discharged them 2 weeks before, and they didn't take their meds, or they lost their meds, and they're back in again. And so my sense is a fairly small number that are really primary care. We probably have 40 or 50 patients in our hospital today who've been there more than 50 days.
Really?
They don't have any resources. There's not a nursing home that'll take care of them, and we can't discharge them.
Because they don't have coverage.
They have no resources, and we can't discharge them to the street. They're too sick to the street.
Give me that number again.
Probably 50.
About 50 who have been there for how long?
Greater than 50 days.
Mr. Armstead, what happens? There's models that we've run of a 75% lip or a 50% mm-hmm. lip. Let's say we compromise and do a 75% lip. What happens to UF Health Jacksonville at a 75% lip? So that 120 million becomes 90 million total between the hospital and the physicians. What's the future of UF Health Jacksonville?
Unless I get the city to lend me some money, probably not very good. I mean, if you just think, again, it's pretty simple. I'm break even. I got 50 days of cash.
You need the full 95.
And so I need the 95 million. If I get cut 5 million, then I can survive because right now I'm making 5 million. So that put me right at zero. If I have a reduction beyond that, then it's just, you know, I can probably get credit for another few months.
So, right. And then, Mr. Boyce, what happens? Tell me about a Jacksonville without UF Health. What happens then?
MASH units, I can't even really envision not having UF. There's just not enough beds or not enough providers in the community to handle the need.
How many beds do you have?
Let me ask one question real quick to Representative Jones, because I know Representative Jones works for the mayor's office as well. So, in the event that we don't fund LIP, who does Mr. Armistead turn the keys over? Would it be the mayor or would it be the governor? Who would he give the keys to?
It's the city's hospital. It would come.
Okay, so it would be the mayor then.
But you know, we're in the process of looking at, you know, what would be that emergency situation. What could be put in place in order to address that, and not acting on this, not addressing this. It's just something that I don't think anybody even wants to even go to sleep on.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
We've got to do this. This is not an option for Jacksonville. We have to have this addressed.
I got you. Is there anyone in the delegation that disagrees? I mean, this is our full efforts to make this happen, to fully change the landscape. I don't know how to make it even a bigger deal than it already is. It's a big deal. But, Madam Chair, I don't know if you need a motion from us to support it or how we go forward.
Well,
the Senate has supported it. I know there's members of the House that have supported the full LIP plan. I'm in. And
we're not here to take a motion on anything. Mm-hmm. What we are here to do is to get more information as to, you know, the particular case mix. And I hear you say we need the full $95 million. But I also hear you say that $95 million goes through a very complex formula. And so we all can expect that LIP will change. That formula will perhaps change. And so understanding what that formula needs to look like so that UF Health is protected, that's really where I need to get a greater understanding. That $31 million that just is a straight pull, the Senator King special allocation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, help me understand what that is and what kind of category that even falls under.
I believe that was established in roughly
2005, somewhere right there.
Yeah, we went through a reorganization, the city put $70 million into us. Shands Gainesville put $70 million. Both, this was the University Hospital and the City Hospital. There were two hospitals. Both were about to go broke. And the city came in, Gainesville came in, put money in, reorganized, didn't lose any of the debt. All the debt holders remained in place, and the place became more efficient. This was an idea about, I think they changed some management structure, and in that process, Senator King put $31 million in to help the financing, because the city had put $70 million in, and it was a way to make the place work.
So do you just get a check every month?
Quarterly.
Quarterly.
Quarterly distributions from...
And it's so basically it goes through this big formula, and then every quarter you get a check for 20-some million dollars? Is that how it works?
I think we actually get multiple transfers.
But totaling?
Yeah, but it's $95 million in total, but in different programs.
Okay, so it's not kind of the situation where somebody comes to your facility and then you're saying, okay, well, we need to pull down an extra $10,000. It's more of an aggregate.
No.
Aggregate
amount,
every quarter you're getting this money.
The amount is fixed, sent to us. It's our issue to manage the place.
Okay, so you're really using these dollars for your operating costs.
Yeah, there's no unique funding. I mean, it doesn't say it has to go for this. It just supports our mission.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
There's a couple of different questions I want to ask as well. Please.
Okay, go ahead.
Russ, if you could talk to us a little bit. You had an opportunity to look at the plan that Senator Bean put together over in the Senate as it relates to, and we'll just talk about the LIP funding for a moment. How does that plan, when you see that plan, how does that plan play out for UF Health in your being able to continue to serve the community?
That plan works fine. Their proposed plan, now it includes the expansion money as well, and the models that I've seen, we're like $3 million more than the $95 million.
Okay.
So we're fine financially with that. The issue, and one of the points I've tried to make, is that because this is the third year in a row I've been here about some crisis,
mm-hmm.
and it's all surrounding the same
mm-hmm.
issue, which has to do with how funds are ultimately distributed,
mm-hmm.
whether they're Medicaid or LIP or whatever you want to call them, through the legislature. And the reason I'm here is because, frankly, the model we have is unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a miracle the place just hobbles along, and through your help, the grace of God, and whoever else, we get enough money that we stay open. But the basic structure, and part of the reason we have expanded to the north, is to improve the commercial payer mix.
Right, right.
So we make some money, and we use that money to help cover the cost of the uninsured. It's really pretty simple.
Right, right.
And if we don't figure out how to fix that, I happen to believe the amount of money that we need from the city is a pension issue. It's a $40 million number in addition to the 26.
Wow.
So, that's self-serving because I'm the guy at the hospital. But I can tell you, if I had the percentage that Jackson gets in Miami from their local tax and sales tax, instead of $26 million, I'd get $135 million. I don't need $135 million. But what I need is for this hospital to be just sustainable, it needs to make $25 or $30 million so that I can invest. I've got $100 million of deferred maintenance, elevators, air conditioners, equipment, stuff.
All that comes out of the 26.
All of that comes out of whatever I make. I've got to make excess money. to reinvest. And we have reinvested. We put $35 million in 8th Street 2 years ago. We put $22 million in this year in equipment. And that's part of the reason I can't build a balance sheet, because I take all my cash and I'm buying equipment, but I know I've got a list of deferred stuff, some of which, you know, when it breaks, I put a roof on last year of the pavilion, $1 million, because every time it rained, we had three rooms that we had to move patients out because the water came in the room. And, you know, and that affects your reputation. That's, you know, it makes it harder to get commercial business. So part of making this place sustainable is we either get the money through the LIP program or the local government or the state.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that.
Excuse me, ma'am.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
The question I'd like to ask is something, pardon how this may sound, but some have stated to me that they believe that the problem that hospitals that are dependent on this have built the wrong model in terms of depending on LIP funding, depending on federal funding that we're going to have. One, I'd like to know, do you believe that that is true? And if it is true, is there a different way to help you build a different model from this point going forward? That I'd like to ask that first, and then
sure. I think we are on the wrong model, but the issue is we take care of the poor, and so that we're trying with the North to improve the payer mix. And you know, here's the way the system works: we overcharge the commercial people to make enough money to support the people who don't pay. So our model is wrong, but it's because we're almost, I call it, our arms are open to the un and underinsured. And so for me to have a different model is I need to get uglier in the ED and, you know, basically say to people who come in who don't have insurance, just get out on the streets. And really, I mean, I could change the character of the place. That would make me more like a private business. I mean, if you said to me, you don't have to see people who don't have money, I'd be good with that. I'd be like a private business. I mean, I'll tell you, the first thing I did when I got to Jacksonville was I looked at the city contract. We were getting, at that point, we were getting $23 million, and I look at our cost, and we're spending $50 million. So I thought, well, best thing to do with that is just stop it. Okay, just stop taking the city money. So people looked at me and said, here's the problem, Russ. You can stop taking the city money, but the people are still going to come to your emergency room. So you all of a sudden, I can't stop.
How many years ago was that?
That was three. We got the additional money 2 years ago.
So why do you think you're such a magnet for the uninsured?
History. We've been there. We've been at that location. We were the first non-military hospital in Florida.
So you think it's all history?
Pardon?
You think it's all because of history?
Yeah, I think it's in the community. It's where we're located. We're in the, we're close to areas which have higher crime rates. I have metal detectors and security at every emergency room door. We've got like 8 or 9 doors. So it is where we are. Just ask people in Jacksonville, come to our place for trauma, no question. But I don't know if I want to go there for care, because they're up on 8th Street.
Mm-hmm.
Did I answer your...
You did, and not surprising that's correct, because I would reject that argument as a whole, but I wanted to ask that question of you. The follow-on question would be to our other hospitals that are in medical centers that are in the area. So let's stop for a second and ask this question. The question is Shams goes away. They walk on your doorstep. The question becomes, is this is, you know, this affects your business model now in a substantial way. The question then would become is, that burden becomes your burden, everybody else's, you know, around the table here. What can we do
then through your facilities to be able to help back over here, because, you know, it's obvious why you would be at the table with us, because, you know, absent Shan's puts a significant burden on you. Now, I'm not suggesting, you know, that would be something that twists its way back around, but how do, you know, what can you do? How can you participate in this? Because the reality is that we're going to be hamstrung here, despite my friend Senator Bean, you know, that we're battling in things that we aren't going to be able to necessarily have the full control. We may have a part of that control, but it's negotiations are going to go between the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. They're going to sit down, they're going to come up with something, and when they do, they're going to come back and say, these are the plans that we think that we can work with. It's doubtful that we're going to come back up with $95 million, however we slice that pie. The reality is what solutions can you bring to the table other than telling us that we're out of line and we need to be doing something different and figuring something out? We're going to need some assistance because there's only so much that we're going to be able to get. What can you offer into that discussion with us?
Well, this weekend, we'll jump in. Our CEO, Hugh Green, spoke to the leadership of our medical staff, and one of the things he said was that he can't envision a scenario where we don't have UF in the community. And I think Mr. Green has as good of a view of the healthcare market and all the dynamics in Northeast Florida regarding healthcare as anybody. But, you know, hearing him say he just can't envision what it would be like. I mean, so our hospital, very full, and I would imagine St. Vincent's occupancy, very full. So it's not like we, the hospitals collectively, I'm sure Mayo runs pretty high census. And then you have, you know, small hospital at the beaches, smaller hospital that we have down south that's very full, small hospital up in Nassau County. The Memorial, Orange Park's pretty full. So there's not really the capacity. You know, if we all could say, well, we could just absorb that volume in the rest of the hospitals in the community. In other words, there's vacancy available, but it's like, you know, a lot of hotels. We all have pretty much a no vacancy sign up. So that's really the difficulty. We would still be full without UF, but now where would those folks go? Russ said about 75% of his inpatient admissions come through the ER. So our large hospital that's on the other side of the south side of the river, downtown there at Baptist, right off 95, 70% of our inpatient admissions come through the emergency room. So that's probably pretty
much
true.
Much less for us, but that's we're in practice.
Yeah. So pretty much true for St. Vincent's, for Memorial.
Then what would be a scenario here? Because, you know, this is purely just talking and going back to the city and, you know, and working and having that nature. And that would be one that would be a fee to patients that are walking in that are, you know, in addition to something else that we could use and help fulfill this, because otherwise what I would see is that we're going to wind up, you know, with something that's going to put a business model that's going to be, you know, destruction to everything that we've done. And I don't think that there's going to be a will at the legislature to put a tax. I don't think there's going to be the money at the city. I mean, maybe there is, but is there a path by which a model along that line could be developed? I don't know. I'm looking for solutions. I'm looking at political realities tied into that. And I don't know. Do you have any suggestions? And what would that number of dollars look like as well?
You're talking about levying a tax on the other hospitals?
Something of that nature. I know that's not something that can be. But I don't know.
Would you levy it just on local patients, or would you levy it on all patients that come to the place?
It's just a discussion.
Yeah, let me be fair for the record. I'm not in favor of that.
I don't think that very clear.
All right, I don't think anybody's...
Let me make it very clear. I'm not suggesting anything. I'm simply saying we've got a problem, and we've got to talk about everything, you know, all solutions. So it's not about looking at raising a tax, putting a tax on you or anybody else in this room. It's looking about solutions because, you know, there's political realities that are going to happen out of here and going to happen out of Washington. They're going to impact everybody in this room and everybody in our region. And so, you know, I think that we have to be willing to step back and say, what are solutions that could be out there? And that's not saying that I'm looking for anything. I'm asking questions, not, you know, not making suggestions. I'm asking questions.
I think it's important we stand firm. The federal government mandates that anybody that walks into Mr. Armistead's place gets treated. We need to send them the bill. They need to honor their commitment of continued funding in some form. It may change in some form or fashion, but we need to be unified to say that we need that number. You've already heard him. Three-quarters doesn't get it. 80% doesn't get it. It's got to be very close to the 100% number, or what 20% of Chan's customers are you going to turn away if we don't get the full, or if they're even there. So it's something that we all stand firm. I hate to run. I want to say that I know you'll probably take it up first thing tomorrow morning on the House floor.
I'll be there. I'll bring a flashlight. We're all set.
Okay. DuVall delegation will be at the door of the House.
Oh, very good.
All right.
That's good. It looks like we'll be back, though. You're going to be back.
I should also point out that we have 350 residents and fellows in our training programs. They'll all be gone. They'll be in other places.
And their specialties, there's an identified shortage.
And that's another category that you draw down from.
But that's all in the 95.
Right, right. And I understand that. But as we move forward, that formula is probably still going to be there. It may change. But I need to understand. I'm going back to my very first question. I need to understand of that 95 million, what's the breakdown? How much are you getting because you've got a teaching hospital? How much is because you're a safety net? How much is because, you know, you are a trauma center? How much is because of the uninsured, et cetera, et cetera? I really need that breakdown as we move forward. And then my next question is, for every dollar that historically Florida has put into the LIP program, do you have a ballpark of how much we've gotten back? For instance, my numbers say that we've got a $2.17 billion shortfall. Roughly $1.3 billion of that is federal dollars. So it's kind of a little bit more than half. Does that feel right?
But I think most of the money that Florida puts in comes from IGTs, not from
the hospitals, right?
You know, from South Florida.
Yeah.
And do we know what that number looks like? Do you know?
865 million.
I think that's
865 million.
IGTs.
So 865 million of the 2.17 billion is contributed. Is that correct?
Right.
So that's roughly a little bit more than a third.
Yeah.
A little bit more than a third that we put in and then comes back. So is it fair to say that you took that 2.17 minus the 865, that's the bulk of the problem? Because if we didn't send that money...
Probably right.
If you don't send that money up, then you don't get that...
Well, I know. You don't send it up, but you still have that money.
Well, the hospital that send it keep that money.
Yeah.
It doesn't get
It doesn't get distributed
what comes
across
back,
the whole state.
Because I get about the 26 from the city. I get another 4 from this redistribution of IGTs, that the money that comes back doesn't all go. Every area gets all of their money back.
Right.
But the match doesn't go to each place based
fairly,
on how much money
equally.
They put. It's in this formula.
Because we send that money up, and then they're paying interest at 8.5.
Yeah, but plus it gets doubled.
I mean, there's a doubling, and then there's the...
And so then there's a redistribution, kind of a leveling out.
Yeah.
So that $4 million, is that part of the $95 million? Or is that in addition to the $95
million? That $4 is included in the $95.
In the $95.
The $26 from the city is not included in that $95.
Right, okay. All right. How much of the population that you serve is like with a mental illness, and is that a big part of the services that you're providing?
See, I mean, we're a Baker receiving facility, and we have an inpatient psych unit across the street, and we're no different than probably any other hospital. One of our major admitting diagnoses is psychosis.
So is that kind of a contributing factor? If you were to say our model is unsustainable as it is today, and these are the contributing causes to the fact that it's unsustainable, there's not a whole lot you can do about your location, okay? But in terms of the primary diagnoses of what you're serving, I guess I'm trying to figure out if there's a way to rearrange that.
Well, mental illness is a major problem in the country and in our community. And so, the problem is there's only so much money. If you wanted to say, here's a formula, and we'll give you so much money for each patient that has a mental illness, you'd be bankrupt pretty quick. I mean, the reason...
So that's a big part of what you do.
The reason these dollars are capped is... People said they can't afford it, and so they say, okay, you got this much money, you make it work. And that's how we got to this distribution. I believe, and actually Tony Corbello, who is works with the Safety Net Hospital, Tony's much more fluent with this than I am, but my sense is that these LIP funds have been used to fund mostly the 14 safety net hospitals to cover costs for stuff they otherwise couldn't cover, whether it's trauma, whether it's neonate, whether it's a burn unit, it's the high expense items. And the safety net hospitals have gotten the majority of this LIP money.
Okay, if we were not... Go ahead.
Not last year, but year before last, I think it was, there was a redistribution of the LIP funding, and the formula changed to increase the number of hospitals that were receiving dollars. So it wasn't, just the safety net hospitals that were getting it, but I want to say it was Representative Shank under his FOSSET model that he created, that he changed the distribution.
Yes, that was the tiering.
Yes.
And that didn't happen. If that had happened, we would have lost $30 million. Okay. And this discussion I would have had last year. And you wouldn't have had us here. You wouldn't have me here this year.
Okay. Let's go back to the 14 safety net hospitals. If most of the $2.17 billion are going to those 14 safety net hospitals, but we know that Baptist is getting roughly $14 million, do we know the total... the sum that the 14 are getting versus everybody else?
Yeah, and I don't have it with me, but
roughly,
Tony has that.
It's in that presentation. It's in the Senate packet.
It may be, I'll pick a number, 40% or 50%. It's just, if you did it based on, let's say, Medicaid patients, it would be very different because you have lots of hospitals who see a few Medicaid patients. But they don't get any of this LIP. So if you said, okay, everybody who sees a Medicaid patient gets $10, okay, that would dramatically change what was left for the 14 safety net hospitals or the amount of money that I get, because it's designed to cover what I believe is a lot of other unfunded patients.
So how do we get around the federal rule that says if you bill Medicaid for a patient, that Medicaid payment is payment in full? There's a federal rule that says that. How are we getting around that when we're using LIP dollars to supplement?
We're not using them for we use them for other patients. So I hear your question about how does that work. I don't know. But we're not double billing. We're only billing, and the payments, and part of the reason I get the extra money, that's $4 million I mentioned, is hospitals can't receive more than their Medicaid cost on the Medicaid cost report.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so that's why they're, all the money, I'll say, doesn't go back to South Florida, because once they reach that cap,
it's a redistribution.
Then the rest of the money is distributed.
Okay. So if as the legislature, if we focused on the 14 safety net hospitals as we're crafting a solution, then that would help further refine the problem, but be a big help to UF Health.
Yeah, I think so. And you have to remember, we're the poster child. Because I have the weakest balance sheet and income statement, I'm the first one to go.
Right.
So the other hospitals, while they need this money desperately, they generally have more financial resources than we do
to weather the storm.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the $100 million. The $100 million in deferred maintenance, because that's really pretty alarming to me.
I'm not trying to scare people.
No, what I'm trying to understand is how long has that been going on? So we've got $100 million in maintenance needs that need to be filled, and obviously that has an impact on, you know, the type of clientele that you're able to attract. How long has that $100 million being? How long have you been deferring maintenance? 5 years, 10 years, forever?
Well, I've only been there three, but I'd say probably at least 10.
10 years.
And so what we do is we bring, I mean, I'll give you an example. Beds. Okay. This is hard to believe. A bed costs $25,000 to $30,000 each.
Are you kidding me?
No, a bed.
A bed?
A bed.
Wow.
And so we've got, you know, 600 beds. So you're talking, and you know, some of the beds are only $15,000, but it's basically a $10 or $12 million capital commitment. So this past year, I bought $2.5 million worth of beds, and over the next 4 years, I'm going to try to replace the bed. Our beds have an average of life of 8 to 10 years. Generally, hospitals try to replace beds in 5 to 6 years because you have, you know, lots of people spend a lot of time in the bed, so you know these air mattresses and moving chambers so that you minimize the cubitus ulcers,
sure,
and
sure.
Those kinds of things. So there, it's just it's an expensive industry, and that's just one example. And last year was the first time. We said we just have to do something with the replacement of the beds.
So, do you also pay $25,000 to $30,000 a bed?
We don't have the ability to cap what we're going to pay for a bed. I mean, it's pretty much you pay what you have to pay, and device companies and so forth. You know, the government isn't saying you can only charge X for a bed. So yes, it's expensive, but they're very complicated, as Russ said, in terms
it's like
of
a
ulcers
car.
And movement and. Equipment and so forth.
You do like financing?
Wow.
Those types of items.
We look and see what's the best terms we can get. Do we finance with the company? Do we try to borrow some money from the bank, or do we do some tax exempt financing? Whatever seems to work.
I hate to run, but I do want to thank you for coming over. It is important. There's no question about it. Bringing in the relevance of what happens to the balance of the community is the most important thing to this delegation and to those of us who are here. And I'll be looking forward to our next round of discussions in ways that we can do. Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
We have almost 7,000 employees when you consider UF and the other organizations on 8th Street. It's pretty big.
So you referenced the spreadsheet, and I just want you to kind of comment on what the titles mean, because we talked about UF Jacksonville and Duval, $519 million operating revenue, $2.2 million operating margin. So talk to me about what you mean by operating revenue. Is that total what?
That's cash we receive, or from an accrual accounting point of view, that's the income coming in.
And that's within your fiscal year, which runs?
July 1 to June 30.
Okay, and does that include the $95
million? Yes.
Okay, so if you were to subtract that 95 from the 519, you'd have roughly 424.
Yes.
Okay. And then the $2.2 million, that's what you have
left over
after you've paid all your bills.
Yes.
Okay, which represents 0.44%. And then how is the operating margin different than the total margin of 2.49?
For us, it's probably not much different. For most hospitals, it tends to be the investment earnings, the interest that they've earned on their investments. It could be stock market up and down. We just don't have any. So that's why ours tends to be the same number.
Okay, that's...
And that can also be a pretty misleading number, because maybe the stock market goes up one year and somebody makes a lot of money, and next year the stock market goes down and they lose money. The operating margin is what you met on your operations, on the operations.
So that's the number we really need to be looking at.
Yes.
That's the important number. Although there's, as you said, there's not very much difference for you. Okay. All right. Do you have any further questions?
Is there any what hospitals get more than you do from the...
That's a good question.
The largest one is Jackson in Miami, and I think, I can get you the number, but I think it's about $245 million. Gainesville, I believe, is next, and I think they get about $125 million from LIP. And then I think I may be third. There may be somebody else that's close.
Okay.
Jackson is getting 200.
The safety net hospitals in total get... Oh, I can't remember. I'm sorry. I can give you a schedule on exactly how much it is and where the money goes to. Safety net hospitals and other hospitals, whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit.
Yeah, so as we wrap up, I want to thank everybody for being here tonight. This has been very helpful for me to kind of drill down and get some of these questions answered. I do want to ask one more time, though, if you can get me kind of in the weeds numbers, okay?
Yeah.
Because as we move forward, if there's, let's say, a particular category that currently you're getting dollars in LIP now, but all of a sudden that category goes away, it'll be helpful for this delegation to know exactly what that is going to mean to UF Health and to Baptist as well. And so even though I hear what you're saying, that you need that full $95 million, we need to know how you're drawing that $95 million down.
Yeah, that's right. If I could stop doing something that made a material difference, I would. For example, I've thought about closing the trauma center. Because I could save a little bit of money, but I wouldn't save enough to make a difference, and I would damage the community pretty dramatically. I'd also close the community clinics that we have, because I lose money on that, but we're trying to keep people out of the emergency room, and we're trying to provide better primary care for them. So there are some things I can do. They just don't save. There's nothing I can do to save $95 million.
Okay, but that raises another question. The community clinics, okay? And I was kind of going down that line of questioning earlier with the primary care. If in the solution that we craft, if we could provide additional funds somewhere else for those community care, and maybe it's not under the LIP model, but maybe it's just something else, then would that be helpful to you in terms of covering?
Any money I get that displaces,
whether it's LIP or not, okay.
Again, as I say, the reason I'm a poster child is it's really easy for people to equate. I've got maybe $5 million I can lose and before I start losing money. And you can call it whatever you want. whatever makes people comfortable, if they're willing to fund, we can do. But it's a large number. And remember, the physicians at UF are essentially breaking even, and they need $25 million to continue to break even. So if you fix my $95 million and you don't pay them, I've lost they're losing $25 million.
Okay. So the problem's 120.
Yeah.
Okay. That's helpful.
Madam Chairman, I want to thank you for having the meeting and recognizing that this is not an issue that we as a city can sit back and as a community, as a region, can sit back on, but that we do need to hear the facts and we need to hear from those who are living it. I would also recommend that, as I've shared with some of our delegation members, that you listen to the April 20th meeting because they laid out a very good historical overview in an unbiased way. You'll also hear from Russ in that presentation, and you'll get a better understanding of how we got here
mm-hmm.
and what it's going to take for us to be able to address this long term. And I think ultimately that's what we need to start doing is addressing this long term and not just putting a Band-Aid on it, because again, we end up back here again next year and the following year and the year after that.
And it gets old.
If we keep playing the game of we'll just throw just a little bit more, we'll throw just a little bit more, instead of making sure that we're addressing the true issue of it. And so again, I want to thank you for that. I would ask if you could ask our entire delegation to make sure that they look at that, listen to it. I spent 3.5 hours listening to it, and we'll listen to it again, because each time I listen to it, I learn something else.
Mm-hmm.
And but the one thing that I knew before I listened to it, and the one thing that I know now after listening to it, is we can't afford to lose UF Health. That's just not an option that we as a community can afford. And for every bill that I might pass, for anything else that we get in the budget, I don't think anything is worth that.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Any final comments?
I want to just follow up. You brought behavioral health, mental health, mm-hmm. and how critical that really is in the community. UF provides behavioral health and Baker Act facility. We do the same, pediatric and adult, inpatient, outpatient. And you know, a business model would be shut down behavioral health, because you don't make money on behavioral health, but it's so vital to the community. We're committed to the community, we're committed to the community. And you ask, well, you know, what's the impact of behavioral health? We're starting to put therapists in our primary care offices because there's such a need for that. But the primary care physician isn't really equipped to deal with mental health issues, but if there's one right there in the office, they can see them. And if you read about accountable care organizations, there are articles coming out now that mental health is such a key component of managing population health. So many hospitals in the community have jettisoned their behavioral health units. They don't provide it anymore. And so there aren't many left doing it. And to see that service go, which has such a downstream impact
right.
on other conditions, is vital. So just wanted to make sure the emphasis there, in and of itself, you know, it doesn't look like a large service line. You do lose money doing it, but it has such an impact elsewhere. It's very critical.
I absolutely concur. In fact, the House just passed a bill today, Senate Bill 7068, that deals with mental health and trying to reduce the need for crisis-driven care for our mentally ill. And I think that's exactly what both of you are talking about. It not only puts the community at risk from a public safety perspective, right. but it puts our community at risk in terms of the cost. The healthcare costs. So,
Come by and visit us anytime. We'll show you the emergency room. We don't have to set anything up. You just walk in, and this is pretty. Today we use the colors. And I think they did it when I got there, so it was easy for me to keep up with. Green, yellow, orange, and red. Red means we don't have any beds. And we have patients in the emergency room, and we have patients scheduled for surgery who need beds, and we don't have any. And we're typically like that at least 3 days a week. And we're trying to move patients in. It's also affected by the patients that we can't discharge because...
Right, there's 50.
And because, remember, whoever takes them assumes the responsibility for their care. So nobody wants to take them. And we get them just as bad. You get them through the emergency room. And we have social workers. We work. We try to get them qualified. We have some people that we don't have a name or an ID. And
what do you do?
You keep them alive.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate everybody's time and participation today.
Thank you.